Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
It is not a partisan witch hunt. That's the mantra to keep repeating over and over. It is not. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. What am I talking about? Arlen Specter, the Republican from Pennsylvania, joined three Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy of Vermont, Dianne Feinstein of California, and Charles Schumer of New York, to say to Alberto Gonzalez, we don't believe we have all the documents, sir. We want to figure out why you fired these attorneys. And let me add to the good senators, many of us here in America would like to know why so many of the attorneys are still there. And then there's this whole other issue which is coming out now about many of these attorneys, many of these prosecutors have been brought to Washington, D.C. for, in some cases, a year or 2 years at a time. So no federal prosecutions are even going on in some districts where perhaps the Republican dirty tricks are kicking into high gear. So, I mean, does that account for why there's no prosecution for voter for election fraud in Ohio or in Florida, for example? So, anyhow, Monica Goodling, among the missing documents mentioned was a chart cited in a February 12, 2007 email message, this from the New York Times today, from Monica Goodling, a former aide to Mr. Gonzalez, two other department officials. So, these senators are saying, a bipartisan group of senators, 25% Republican, one Republican and three Democrats, saying to the Justice Department, come on, you have an obligation, you have a legal obligation, frankly, to give us this information. This is just straight up. And interestingly, at the same time that this is happening, there's good news and bad news with regard to Jack Abramoff, which may well end up tying into Monica Goodling and some of the other graduates of Pat Robertson's university and the Justice Department and all. And who knows where all this will go if anybody ever actually is able to follow the trail and do an investigation. And Congress is trying, but the Justice Department is stonewalling like crazy. The bad news about Jack Abramoff is that he has been plea bargaining to get a lighter sentence, and it looks like he's being successful. The tentative, the Associated Press story we're hearing is that quite possible that Jack Abramoff is going to get a lighter sentence. That's, you know, arguably the bad news. A federal judge Monday, this is from from MSNBC, Joel Seidman, a federal judge Monday granted the government's request for a new hearing to determine an appropriate reduction in Abramoff's sentence, a reward based on his continued cooperation with investigators and several federal probes. Okay, so that's he's serving this 5.5-year sentence on this conviction with regard to the Florida-based Sun Cruise Casino's gambling boat fraud case. And by the way, why didn't a U.S. attorney in Florida ever look into the guy who was the owner of Sun Cruises, who right after he sold it to Jack Abramoff was murdered, as I recall, unless I'm missing something here, which I may be, I mean, from time to time. But in any case, that's the bad news, is that he may be getting a lighter sentence. The good news is that he may be getting a lighter sentence. Why? Because it means he's singing. Who's he talking about? Is it somebody inside the Bush administration? We'll see. A bit of an overview here of a few things that are going on that I think are of note. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have now followed the lead of John Edwards in saying the Fox Noise machine, the Fox Noise channel, thank you very much. We are not going to play in your sandbox. Not going to participate in debates that are sponsored or hosted by the Fox Noise channel. They're not going to do it. And I think that's, as Keith Olbermann calls it, I think that's very wise. So we've got a lot we're going to be talking about today as well, by the way. In the second hour of our program, what about the religious basis of America. Is there a religious basis to American law? I will argue that there frankly is not. And to give you some citations going back to Jefferson, Alan Reinbach, or Reinach, is going to be arguing that there is. And in the third hour of our program, Peter Eisner is going to be here. He's the author of a new book, The Italian Letter on Yellowcake Uranium, the letter that started the whole thing, that ended up with the Niger document and Bush and his State of the Union address and everything else. Before I get into all that stuff, and I'm going to come back to this tracking this email thing, because I think that this is really the biggest story of the day, is what's going on with the email trail, and I will return to that in just a moment. But I want to digress for just a moment, because you can't take your eye off the machine. Yesterday we talked a little bit about how the Paul Krugman's piece in the Sunday New York Times about the big lie and the little lies. And there is a big lie that has been flying around the web for a year or two. It's probably much older than that. It probably, you know, goes back decades. I mean, who knows? But it is a major big lie about Social Security. And let's not forget that this is one of the major goals of this administration. I mean, you know, from the very beginning, from George W. Bush running for the House of Representatives in, as I recall, 1977, his unsuccessful attempt to run for Congress from Texas, his main platform was privatizing Social Security. I mean, there's this large group of Republicans that go all the way back to 1935, 1936, when Social Security was first put into place, a large group of Republicans representing probably the majority of the party, who have always felt that a program that two-thirds of it goes for elderly people who are retired and one-third of it goes for widows, orphans, and disabled people, that is socialism. And that widows, orphans, and disabled people should show up at the local church with their handout, or show up at the local rich person's house with their handout, and that old people, if they hadn't been fortunate enough or been successful enough to set aside enough money that they could live on in their old age, that they should sit on an ice floe and you know, head out to sea. And Social Security was really at the core of the New Deal, the whole thing of the New Deal with Social Security and unemployment insurance and strong union protection, the Wagner Act in 1935, and you know, just all of these things that made it possible for the middle class to emerge in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, until Ronald Reagan started deconstructing the New Deal in 1981, and that's been an unrelenting and ongoing process ever since. I mean, keep in mind this ongoing message.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And one of the ways that they're doing something about that is viral marketing. There is this very aggressive viral marketing campaign going on with regard to the Social Security program. And this email that goes out, I've gotten three of them in the last week. And actually, I've also gotten several emails from listeners saying, I just got this in the mail, and an email from, you know, 25 of my friends, and I want to know how to respond to it. And very often these emails start out with, in fact, one of the ones that I got says, many years ago in Seattle, two wonderful neighbors, Elliot and Patty Roosevelt, came to my home to swim on a regular basis. They were a great couple full of laughter, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Both are now deceased, but their stories remain. Many discussions about their parents, Franklin D. and Eleanor Roosevelt, and how his father and mother never intended for the Social Security and welfare programs to turn out the way they are today, which seems like it's giving credibility to the story. And then they go on, this letter then goes on to say, and I'm just going to put these up and knock them down one at a time here for you. Number one, that participation in the Social Security, Franklin Roosevelt promised that participation in the Social Security program would be completely voluntary. No, he didn't. As they note over at Snopes.com, which is one of the best debunking sites, particularly for this, there was no provision in the Social Security Act of 1935 for the payment of Social Security payroll taxes to be voluntary. None. You can't have a system that protects everybody in the country if everybody in the country doesn't participate in it. It was never intended to be completely voluntary. Number two, that the participants would only have to pay 1% of the first $1,400 of their annual incomes into the program. Sorry, that's a lie also. Social Security taxes were never limited to the first $1,400 in annual income, and there was never a provision that it would fix the tax rate at 1%. In fact, the original law said that over the from 1935 until 1943, the rate would rise from 1% to 3%. It even specified the rate, the increase. This is in the original law. It actually would end all the way up in December 31st, 1948. The rate would be 3%. So lie number two. There's a series of lies in here. I just want to give you these points so that you can use them to debunk these, because you will get one of these emails. This viral marketing campaign is really running full tilt boogie. More right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
It's the place where being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. I've been sitting on this thing for weeks here now, and given that it seems like the only thing the media wants to talk about is Don Imus. Oh, man. Yeah. Don Imus, who earned the wrath of Fox News, this is not to minimize what he said. I think it's terrible. And Gwen Ifill had a great comment on it that you can find over the thinkprogress.org blog, this is a very, very destructive thing that Don Imus said. But Fox, last night, MSNBC did a segment on why is it that Fox News is turning this into a whole huge thing. Well, I think this may have something to do with it. Well, not just... Why is it that Fox News is trying to find a political agenda in Imus just, you know, generically making a racist statement? It's bad enough that he's a racist, or that he's sounding like one. I'm not quite sure if we're ready to give him the benefit of the doubt. But in any case, why is it that Fox News is trying to take it into the area of political conspiracy? Well, here's why, I think.
Here's what O'Reilly's doing. You are not going to believe this. This son of a bitch actually went on that falafel thing of his, and he said, if you'll buy a copy of his book, for every... We're not going to believe this.
Oh, here we go.
I hope you pull your car over the side of the road. Pull it over the side of the road. Here's what O'Reilly says. For every copy of his stupid book that you buy, he'll send a copy to a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah. So, in answer to the question MSNBC was asking on the air last night, why is Fox turning this into something that it's not? I mean, it's bad enough what it is, but you know why? Well, it's very simple. But in any case, I figured on a day when everybody wants to talk about that, I want to get into something that is actually going to impact your life at some point, guaranteed. And is impacting your life right now if you're working and paying taxes. And that's the Social Security Trust Fund, or the Social Security system. So this viral marketing campaign getting very, very aggressive. They're, you know, talking to people who are conservatives, who get all the conservative, you know, spin arounds and blogs and whatnot. Everybody has seen this thing. Okay, so this letter that claims to be, oh yeah, we knew Franklin Roosevelt's children or one of his sons, and number one, that Social Security would be voluntary. Lie, wrong. Number two, participants would only pay 1% of the first $1,400. Wrong, a lie. Number three, that the money would be deductible from income tax for tax purposes. Wrong, it's a lie. Never was part of the law. Never, you know, hasn't been. Number four, that the money the participants put into the independent trust fund rather than the general operating fund, and therefore would only be used to fund the Social Security retirement program and no other government program. And then later on, they ask, you know, rhetorically, the question, which political party took Social Security from the independent trust fund and put it into the general fund so that Congress could spend it? The answer is it was Lyndon Johnson, the democratically controlled House and Senate. This is what the email says. Well, first of all, number one, there still is. The Social Security Retirement Fund, the separate trust fund, is still there. And all the money goes into that, number one. So their fourth point is a lie. And then when they say, oh, and now that it's been taken out and put in the general fund so Congress can spend it, that was Lyndon Johnson. That's also a lie. What happened was that Ronald Reagan started borrowing from the trust fund and putting that borrowed money into the general fund and spending it. But it still has to be paid back. So item number four, a lie. Number five, that the annuity payments to retirees would never be taxed as income. That's a lie. It was taxable right from the get-go, right from the very beginning. And then they asked these questions. Which political party took Social Security from the Independent Trust Fund and put it into the general fund? Well, I just told you. They say in the email, this viral email that's going all over the place, it was Lyndon Johnson, democratically controlled House, and said it's a lie. To the extent that Social Security is being raided, it's being borrowed from, it was Ronald Reagan who started in 1983. Question. Which political party eliminated the income tax deduction for Social Security withholding? The Democratic Party. Wrong. There was never an income tax deduction in the first place. Question. Which political party started taxing Social Security annuities? Answer. The Democratic Party with Al Gore casting the tiebreaker. Wrong. Not true. And question, which political party started giving annuity payments to immigrants? My favorite. That's right, Jimmy Carter and the Democratic Party. That's what they say, right? Sorry, wrong. Illegal immigrant people who are not here in the United States and illegally or residents of the United States who have not paid into Social Security cannot get Social Security benefits. It's that simple. They're saying Jimmy Carter started giving money to immigrants in this viral marketing campaign, and it ain't the case. And then they wrap this thing up by saying, then after doing all this lying and thieving in violation of the original contract, FICA, the Democrats turn around and tell you that the Republicans want to take your Social Security away. And the worst part of it is uninformed citizens believe it. Perhaps we're asking the wrong questions this year. Yeah, right. The bottom line, the holy grail for the Republican Party and the corporatists is the hundreds of billions, the trillions of dollars that has flowed through Social Security and will flow through it in the future. They and their banking buddies want to skim a little bit of that off, because even a little bit of $1 trillion is one whole huge bunch of money. And so the next time you get this viral marketing thing in the email, and you will, trust me, if you haven't already, next time you get this thing, just go over to Snopes.com and plug in Social Security. And you'll find the whole debunk. But I wanted to lay it all out for you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
It's the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The right-wing smear machine running full tilt boogie. First on the issues, an aggressive viral marketing campaign, an email campaign targeting all Americans with a series of lies. Not one single truthful statement in that email. When you get it, as I guarantee you will, at some point from somebody, most likely a Republican friend, who thinks that it's true. There is not one single truthful statement in it. It is all lies. And then, of course, there's the politics of personal destruction. For example, Jerry Falwell saying that Hillary Clinton is Lucifer. Lucifer? And then he gets called on it. And
nobody who with a fair mind, open mind, who heard what you just played, did not know that I was speaking tongue-in-cheek about Lucifer running, because there's no way Lucifer's going to run.
Oh, I see. That's why we shouldn't think that you meant that Hillary Clinton is Lucifer. Well, will you apologize then, sir?
Do you believe, especially in a politically charged atmosphere, that you were disrespectful?
I do not.
Do I take this to mean that you will not be apologizing to Senator Clinton?
No, I'll be saying it over and over again.
Okay, so let's see. Jerry Falwell on the record that... Hillary Clinton is Satan. Let's other right wingers.
Sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies. And
yeah, Glenn Beck talking to the only Muslim member of the House of Representatives. John Gibson on Fox News. Let's talk about the fact, well, if John actually lays it out.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies.
More babies.
That's a lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, the story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities.
Oh, you mean white people should have more babies.
By far, the greatest number are Hispanic. Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer.
Oh, white people are having fewer babies, so you better get out there and do your duty, says Fox News.
Put it bluntly, we need more babies.
More white babies, of course.
Forget about that zero population growth stuff that my poor generation was misled on. Why is this important? Because civilizations need population to survive. So far, we're doing our part.
Civilization? You mean white civilization?
Here in America, but Hispanics can't carry the whole load. The rest of you get busy. Make babies. Or put another way, a slogan for our times. Procreation, not recreation. That's my word.
Yeah. Okay. So John Gibson over at Fox News weighing in on the issues of race in America, I guess you could say, you know, arguably, that that's what he's doing. And I mean, but it doesn't stop there, of course. And not just race. I mean, race, religion, gender.
Notice what this double talking slut just did. This mind slut, Barbara Walters.
Oh, Michael Savage. Hello, Michael.
And I stick by those words. She's an empty mind slut. She'd peddle anything for a ratings point. That mental prostitute, Barbara Walters. It sickens me. I think that the woman is vermin. I think she's dirt.
I see. All right. So, and nobody calling Mr. Wiener on the table for that. On the carpet, I guess, would be the correct phrase, right? What about San Francisco?
It's about time.
This is Bill O'Reilly.
You've got a city that constantly diminishes the military in any way, shape, or form. Then the military ought to say, see ya, no fleet week, no commissioning, no money, goodbye. Right?
Absolutely. Amen. And good job to the Navy. I say, go, Navy, go. Don't stop. And I think that this should really just be the first step in sending a strong message to San Francisco that if you are going to dishonor the military will not grace your hate-filled city with its presence.
No, it's a hate-filled city. Well, thank you, Michelle Malkin, who makes a career of talking about bonus babies and how dare immigrants come to the United States and have children who become citizens when her father came to the United States from the Philippines and was not a permanent resident when she was born and immediately granted citizenship. An odd little non sequitur. And you know, it just goes on and on and on. Should we be checking all Muslims, for example? This is Mike Gallagher on Fox News.
It's time to have a Muslims checkpoint line in America's airports and have Muslims be scrutinized. God. You better believe it.
You better believe it. And it just, you know, it just goes on and on. Glenn Beck on Rose.
She goes off on her opinion every step of the way. But there's a conservative on the set who's shut down. You can't just say your opinion. What the hell is this show all about, you fat witch? What is this show about?
Mm-hmm. It seems that there have been more than, you know, one or two times when people on the right, not to say, again, this is absent. I'm taking this out of the context of the IMUS dispute and just talking in general about what is the level of discourse in America, because I absolutely condemn what Don Imus said and, you know, period, end of discussion. And there is this extraordinary pass that the Reich has gotten in over-the-top speech, shall we say, just over-the-top speech in general. And I find that fascinating. I just find it fascinating. So, anyway, Social Security, what's the write-up to? Karl Rove's coming to Portland on Friday, April the 13th, and so I signed up for my wife and I to attend. That should be interesting. I'll report back on Monday if they let me in. I will be respectful, and it should be interesting. Congress, this 1978 Presidential Records Act, this is the thing that's going to come back to haunt the White House, I'm telling you. The 1978 Presidential Records says all decisions made in the White House, there has to be a paper trail basically going back on them. And so because of that, if you're doing official business, you need to be using the official White House web servers, mail servers, because those servers archive the documents so that historians and people filing Freedom of Information requests and things like that can get access to them. Except that, for example, Susan Ralston, the number two to Karl Rove, Karl Rove's assistant, she appears to have used at least four outside email accounts. This is from John McKinnon's piece in today's Wall Street Journal. She once emailed two associates of lobbyist Jack Abramoff and said, quote, I now have an RNC BlackBerry, which you can use to email me at any time. No security issues like my White House email. Yes, Mr. Abramoff apparently very concerned about that. And now Mr. Abramoff is negotiating for a lighter sentence. And this was Karl Rove's assistant. It's all getting very, very strange. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat. It's up at the top of the page. Jack in San Diego, California. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I wanted to debunk my favorite Social Security myth, which is the government spends the surplus and replaces it with worthless IOUs.
Yeah, that was George Bush's, look at this. This is just paper. They're actually treasuries. I mean.
Exactly. When this debate was first going on, I got my information from the Office of the Chief Actuary for Social Security. And what they told me is this, is that in order for the government to spend the surplus, the surplus is invested in various treasury instruments with various maturity dates, and that the average interest rate on the portfolio is about 6%. And here's what's going to happen, is that when the surplus ends in the year 2018, the redemptions of these treasury bills and bonds begin. And it keeps the benefits at 100% until all the redemptions are completed by the year 2042. So in other words, if there are no changes made in Social Security, they pay 100% of the benefits to the year 2042, at which time the surplus that's been invested in the treasury bills have been redeemed, and that is depleted, and then they're going to have to start paying less. Yeah. However, in my opinion, Tom, the only fair way to solve this Social Security problem that is somewhat of a distant future problem is to raise the age of retirement. And here's
there's a real simple solution, Jack. Right now, if you make $90,000 or more, on every dollar that you make after $90,000, you pay no Social Security taxes whatsoever. I'd say, let's just go with Steve Forbes and turn Social Security into a flat tax instead of simply a tax on the middle class.
Well, that is a solution.
And it's a solution that not only would make Social Security solvent, it would probably generate enough additional revenue that you could pay for a national health care program.
Well, here's why I'm saying that to raise the retirement age, which the Greenspan Commission did in the early 1980s, is because this, is that when Social Security started around 1935, the retirement age was 65. That was also the average life expectancy was 65. Yeah. So it was never intended to collect security for 20 years.
No, actually it was, Jack, because people who hit the age of 65 back in the 1920s and 30s were pretty much just about as likely to live until their 80s as they are today. What skewed the numbers is infant mortality. And that's why that argument, which is made particularly on the right, doesn't work. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Broadcasting live coast to coast and around the world from our home base here at 620 KPOJ, Portland's progressive talk station. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Social Security, by the way, we were speaking earlier about minorities in America. One of the larger, actually one of the smaller minorities, given the large minority groups that we heard John Gibson going after, Hispanics and so on. One of the small Muslims in America. What does the right think about that? Michael Savage has some opinions.
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks are where to kill them.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you. Back to Social Security for a second here. And one other point that I have to make. I mentioned that I was on Friday night going to hear Karl Rove speak here in Portland, and I am Louise, my wife, this morning. Said, you know, what do you think if I sign up for this thing? Can we go? You know, and she said, only if you don't get arrested and become the boy toy of a Republican prison warden. So, all right. I, you know, and now I guess I've offended the group of Republican prison wardens. So hopefully that will not come back to haunt. But with regard to Social Security, one of the points that really needs to be made, and I think most Americans are completely unaware of this, is that the boomer generation, that people who will be retiring over the next 40 years, the next 30 years in large part, are the only generation of Americans in the past or in the future to pay not only for their parents' retirement but also for their own. Up until 1982, all of the money that Social Security paid out for retirement, which is two-thirds of what they pay out, and for supporting widows, orphans, and disabled people, which is about a third of what they pay out, all the money that they paid out came from people who are currently earning wages. So today's workers are paying for today's retirees. They saw, the Greenspan Commission saw coming down the road this python, you know, this rabbit going through the python, which is the boomers retiring all at once. And they said, we've got to save up some money for this. So we're going to have the boomer generation pay for their own retirement at the same time that they're paying for their parents' retirement. I kid you not. And Ronald Reagan signed a law that doubled Social Security taxes. And the other half, the additional half that they got as a consequence of this largest tax increase in the history of the United States, signed into law by Ronald Reagan in 1982, what they did with the other half of the money, the surplus, is they set it aside, they put it in this trust fund, and they invested it in treasuries that, as our previous caller noted, are earning interest and will be paid back. They set that money aside and said, this is the money that the boomers who are putting the money in right now will be taking back out in 40 years, 30, 40 years, when they start retiring. And then in 2030, I forget what year it is, but somewhere between 2020 and 2035, when the boomers are pretty much all done retiring, or maybe 2040, they will stop this double taxation, essentially, of Social Security. Well, we'll see. But, you know, they will stop being the population will drop back down of retired people. And the cost of retirement is going to go back down. And so we'll go back to the current generation paying for the retired generation. And it's really that simple. Dick in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Hey, Dick.
Tom, how you doing? First heard you up in Vermont a couple of years ago, and I can't thank you enough for coming on to Air America. Now, I have a couple of things that bother me about Social Security, and it has nothing to do with the plan itself, but Social Security money is my money. Okay?
No, it's not.
This is not, Dick. This is post-tax money, and it belongs to us.
It's not your money, Dick.
Well,
it's not my money.
It's our money.
You're right. It is our money. We collectively got together and said, we're going to create an insurance policy for ourselves.
That's correct.
And that's what it is.
Okay. But what I'm trying to get to is Bush came into office in 2000. And one, and said about the surplus, it's their money. No, it wasn't our money. That was government money that was extracted from us in the way of taxes, and it belonged then to the government. But the Social Security tax is post-tax money, which belongs to us, and it's in trust to the government. Now, there's a couple of things I got to say about that. when you are delinquent, when you owe money in taxes and you can't pay it that year, you have to pay a certain amount of interest, and it's rather high.
Right.
The government should pay that amount of interest on our money that they're borrowing from the Social Security Fund. Okay?
Well, that's you know, an interesting one. You can flip it around. The echo in this is terrible. The argument that the Reagan made was he essentially said, I'm not borrowing from the Social Security Fund to put money into the general trust so that I can spend money and make it look like the economy's good. I'm actually allowing the Social Security Fund to invest their money in an interest-bearing instrument, that being treasuries. It just happens that interest-bearing instrument is, you know, treasury bills, which means that the money then goes into the general fund. You following me?
Fine.
You can argue this either way.
Not a problem. Payback. The only way this money should be paid back into the Social Security Fund is from a surtax on incomes that start above the level of the Social Security tax. All right? Because we have already paid into it. Now, I'm retired, so I'm already collecting Social Security, and so this won't affect me, but it affects. I went through all of this.
You're talking about means testing Social Security, Dick, and this is something that again the Republicans are proposing because they want to turn it into a welfare program because they know that welfare programs. There's a broad consensus in America to destroy welfare programs. There's not a broad consensus to destroy Social Security, and that's you know if I understand correctly what you're saying, and I'm sorry we're you know the hour has run out here for the discussion, but. That you're suggesting that we means test Social Security, that we say, okay, you know, really wealthy people who don't need the money don't get it. Then, again, as I said, you're turning it into a welfare program, and that will be a disaster for Social Security. 57 minutes past the hour.
He is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Well, the slogan on the website, welcome back to the second hour of our program, by the way, the slogan on the website of Regent University, regent.edu, as America's premier graduates, because this is Pat Robertson's university that has 150-plus graduates as members of the Bush administration, including Monica Goodling and her good friend, the prosecutor up in Minnesota, as I recall. The slogan says, as America's premier graduate school dedicated to combining quality education with biblical teachings, Regent continues to produce Christian leaders who will make a difference, who will change the world. And that's perhaps what some of us, going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, are concerned about. Alan Reinach is with us, churchstate.org, the website. He is a constitutional lawyer, a minister, a religious liberty advocate, religiousliberty.info also, serves as the president of the North American Religious Liberty Association. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom. Glad to be with you.
From reading your material and listening to the spots that you have on the internet, people can you know download and put on the radio and whatnot. I think I'm getting mixed messages, or maybe you're just absolutely consistent here. First of all, let me just play one of your spots. This is called Not Guilty.
How does the defendant plead?
Not guilty, Your Honor.
On what grounds?
On account there was no sign posted.
Sign posted?
That's right, Your Honor. I didn't see a single sign where I popped Freddy the finger. No thou shalt not kill signs posted in the alley where I went down.
Not guilty for lack of a sign? When it comes to God's Ten Commandments, what really matters is what's in our hearts.
And then it goes on to talk about writing in our hearts and not on the wall. Are you suggesting... In contradicting many of your conservative peers, that the Ten Commandments should not be posted in public places?
Well, yes and no. Maybe it is a mixed message. Our issue is not so much whether they go up or down in public places. The emphasis is that it really doesn't do a whole lot of good to put them up on the wall. Where they belong is in our hearts. And if they're not in our hearts, putting them up on the wall isn't really going to make a difference.
So to get them into our hearts, you're suggesting that we put them in our public schools? that well, we teach the Ten Commandments.
No, no. The Time magazine piece that ran on the cover for the Easter week that was discussing teaching of religion in the public schools pointed out that for 86% of Americans who call themselves Christians, more than 50% of Americans can't even name one of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So obviously, it's not the public schools that are the problem. It's the churches and our homes that we're not reading our Bibles. We're not, we're biblically illiterate, and we can't blame the public school system for that.
But in your press release, you say that you, Alan Ronick, will argue that the Bible can and should be taught in public schools, well, but that effective teacher training must be part of any such program to ensure that students of all faiths are equally protected, respected, etc.
Let's be clear on what the role of public education is. There's no question that the Bible has tremendous significance in terms of our culture, our civilization, our literature, our arts, our history, our politics, and that it should be taught objectively for its educational value, but not religiously to inculcate faith in the students. That's the job of our homes and churches.
Here's one of the big concerns that I have, and that is that, for example, this Regent University, one of the things that they're teaching these young law students is that our laws in the United States are based on the Ten Commandments.
Which is plainly
it's
wrong.
Exactly. I mean, there's only two of the Ten Commandments that are actually in law.
I've gone through the commandments. Most of them have never found expression in law. And, in fact, we build our entire economy on thou shalt covet, not thou shalt not covet. Imagine if we actually did something with thou shalt not covet, our economy would fall apart.
Yeah. So your suggestion is that we should be teaching comparative religion in public schools?
Well, you know,
do you think that, for example, the Vedas, the Hindu Vedas, should be taught? Do you think that the Four Noble Truths of Buddha should be taught and the Eightfold Path?
There's no question that in terms of the culture and civilization and the influence that we have here in America, that the Bible and Christianity has played a much more important role.
But there are Muslims, there are Hindus, there are Buddhists in this country.
Well, true.
If we're going to teach any particular religion, shouldn't we teach all of them?
I do think that we would all do well to be much better educated about the different world religions. And
why do you want a Ten Commandment Day here in the United States and not a Four Noble Truths Day?
Well,
Buddhist Four Noble Truths are pretty good, aren't they?
I don't know anything about them, but, you know, Christians are going to promote a Ten Commandments Day. You know, religion in America is not the job of government. It's the job of individuals and our associations, whether they're churches, synagogues, Buddhist temples, what have you. So if the Buddhist temples want to promote, you know, their four truths, great.
But if religion is not the business, if that's the case, then why do you want the government to declare a Ten Commandment Day?
I don't want the government to declare a Ten Commandments Day. In fact, I would join with those who would argue in court that it's unconstitutional.
Then why is your website arguing in favor of a Ten Commandments Day?
A Ten Commandments Day privately sponsored by individual churches and privately observed by churches and believers.
I see. Okay. All righty. Alan Ryan, I think this is interesting. You're probably going down the middle more than most folks, I salute that, frankly.
We're among the few Christians, Tom, that still advocate the separation of church and state, which really was the predominant view of Protestant churches for a long time until the last generation or so, when Protestants felt to be in the majority and said, wait a minute, we want our religion promoted by government.
Right.
And that's clearly wrong.
Alan, are you a Seventh-day Adventist?
I am.
I've attended Seventh-day Adventist services, and I have friends who are Seventh-day Adventists. I know that there's a sense among Adventists, and I've been a vegetarian for most of my life, there's a sense among Adventists that there's a certain amount of religious persecution of the group, Certainly a lot of, you know, you disagree with Protestants on which day is the Sabbath, for example. You think Saturday should be the Sabbath and should be honored rigorously.
Right.
And so I'm curious, to what extent is your experience as an Adventist, as a Seventh-day Adventist, and, you know, going back to Ellen White's teachings and whatnot, informing your concern about the tyranny of the majority, given that the majority in this country is Protestant or the supermajority is Protestant and Catholic?
There's no question, Tom, that one's perspective when you're a religious minority is different from that when you're in the majority. So, of course, our position as a minority is going to have an influence. But our theology of religious freedom goes back to the core teachings of the Reformation and the notion that freedom is essential to the gospel of Jesus Christ, that we all have to respond, that God has given us the freedom to respond to him, to have a relationship with him or not, and he doesn't force us. And so it's that principle of non-coercion.
But you're not flipping. You're not flipping it around. You're not saying that therefore the government should be imposing religion upon our kids, for example, or on us.
Well, correct. That religion is not the business of government. It's the business. It's up to all of us to make our own decision, to stand on our own 2 feet. If we're going to have a relationship with God, if we're going to believe in God according to the teachings of any particular religion.
Or gods or not, or, you know, goddesses or nature or whatever it may be.
And we will defend the rights of people of any faith or no faith to their own conscientious beliefs.
Interesting. And very interesting. What's your take on this whole thing of this Regent University School of Law putting all these very, very conservative Protestants into high government positions? We just have about half a minute here.
I share your concern, because there's a definite theocratic tendency on the far right to want to impose very narrow sectarian views of the Bible as the law of the land. And that's inconsistent with the American Republican principle.
Yeah, small R Republican. Well said. Alan Reinach, the website churchstate.org. Alan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. We'll be right back.
This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Indeed, 21 minutes past the hour. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Nope, ain't the case. On February 10th, 1814, here's Thomas Jefferson. He ended up being, he wrapped up his presidency in 1810, or arguably March of 1811, which is when they used to pass the baton, as it were, back then. And so here, 3 years out of being president, he's retired now. And a fellow by the name of Fortescue Allen has raised this issue in the House of Representatives about the Ten Commandments being the basis of American law, and that therefore it should be part of the instruction in schools, and it should be, you know, essentially posted on the wall. I mean, see, this is a repeat of an argument that is going on, ongoing now. So Jefferson writes a letter to a friend of his, Dr. Thomas Cooper, on February 10th, 1814. He says, finally, in answer to Fortescue Allen's question why the Ten Commandments should not now be part of the common law of England or America, we may say they are not because they never were. See, Allen was putting forth this argument, which is being put forth by these people, these lawyers in the Bush administration, who have graduated from Pat Robertson's law school, that the basis of American law is the Ten Commandments. because the basis of American law is American common law is British common law, and that the basis of British common law is Christianity. And the basis of Christianity is the Ten Commandments. That's the logical string that they use. And that's the logical string that was being promoted in 1814. Well, really throughout the late 1700s, early 1800s. And Jefferson just threw it back. He said British common law, on which American common law is based, existed before Christianity arrived in England. Quoting Jefferson in his letter to Cooper, he said, Sir Matthew Hale, who was a conservative advocate for church-state cooperation, lays it down in these words. He says, Christianity is parcel of the laws of England. But it couldn't be, says Jefferson. He says, just looking at the timeline makes it impossible. He says, quoting Jefferson here, but Christianity was not introduced to England till the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place about the year 598, and that of the last about 686. Here, then, was a space of 200 years, during which the common law of England was in existence, and Christianity was no part of it. Not only was it not part of the Ten Commandments, was not part of Christianity, and Christianity was not part of British common law at the time. It wasn't part of American common law, and anyone who suggested it was promoting a lie that they knew was a lie. Jefferson continues in his letter to Cooper. He says, "We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy, and even bolder than they are. It is not only the sacred volumes that the churches have thus interpolated, gutted, and falsified, but the works of others relating to them, and even the laws of the land," he wrote. "Our judges, too, have lent a ready hand to further these frauds, and have been willing to lay the yoke of their own opinions on the neck of others, to extend the coercions of municipal law to the dogmas of their religion by declaring that the Ten Commandments make a part of the law of the land. They do not." Then in 1821, he wrote a similar letter to John Adams, who replied on September 24th, 1821. He says, this is John Adams now, the second president of the United States, the first conservative president of the United States. He's writing to Jefferson. He says, "Hope springs eternal. 8 millions of Jews hope for a Messiah more powerful and glorious than Moses, David, or Solomon, who is to make them as powerful as he pleases. Some hundreds of millions of Muslims is what he said, expect another prophet more powerful than Muhammad, who is to spread Islamism all over the world. Hundreds of millions of Christians expect and hope for a millennium in which Jesus is to reign for 1,000 years over the whole world before it is burnt up. The Hindus expect another and final incarnation of Vishnu, who is to do great and wonderful things I know not what. But you," wrote John Adams to Jefferson, "and I hope for splendid improvements in human society and vast amelioration of the condition of mankind. Our faith may be supposed by more rational arguments than any of the former." Rationality? Yes, rationality is the basis of the Enlightenment. It's the basis of liberal thought. It's the basis of the United States, that we can create a country where life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness can be enjoyed without the interference of religion. And in June 5th, 1824, letter to John Cartwright, Jefferson says, "Our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than the foundation of the Ten Commandments. It presented us an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature and found them engraved on our hearts." Indeed, the laws of nature. In the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson talks about nature's God. What do a herd of deer in England have to teach us about nature's God and Thomas Jefferson? Be right back with that. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com. Shower.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands with that which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. The first sentence of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson wrote that, and John Adams and Ben Franklin sat down to edit the Declaration, and Adams said, wait a minute, this nature's God stuff, it needs to be replaced with a Christian God. And Jefferson said, no. Democracy is natural. It's part of nature. What we are creating here in the United States is consistent with nature. And Adams, being a good conservative, said, no, it's not. The natural state of humans is warfare. We are imposing order on the barbarous natural, the evil natural state of humans. And Jefferson said, no, the natural state is harmony and balance. Look around you in nature. Yes, of course, the foxes eat the bunnies, but there's a balance. There's always balance. And this was the big debate. And for 200 years, it was believed that hierarchy was the actual natural state of things, that kings and kingdoms and nobles and serfs, that was the natural state of things. And that belief is still held by most conservatives. It's at the core of conservative thinking. Read Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, the one that laid it out. And they believe that Darwin proved it. Oh, look, you've got alpha animals. That proves it. So at the University of, I believe it was Sussex, it might have been Essex, I mixed them up, in the United Kingdom, two researchers, Conrad and Roper, decided to test this hypothesis. And then a follow-up study was done that was reported in, as I recall, New Scientist. And they said, let's check out some red deer here, a herd of red deer, and see, you know, because they're near the university, see what happens with them. How do they make decisions? There's three watering holes nearby. Are the deer going to come when the deer, you know, show up? Are they, or when they decide to go to one of the watering holes, is it the alpha deer that says, hey guys, come on, time to go? That was the assumption. After all, why have an alpha deer if you can't boss people around, right? But what they discovered was that the deer would be chewing on leaves or branches or whatever they do, and this is not a small decision, by the way. If they go too early, then some of their members of the herd don't get enough nutrients. If they go too late, some may get dehydrated, and I mean, these are life and death decisions. And if they pick the wrong watering hole, they might have bad water or they might have a predator. So what they found was that when 51% of the deer aligned their bodies pointing in the direction of one of the watering holes, that's when the entire herd would head out. And very often the alpha deer would be in the back, go, hey, where'd everybody go? In other words, the animals are making their decisions democratically. And they're, everybody in the herd is continually voting. You see this with the movement of birds, with fish. You see it with gnats, you know, a ball of gnats floating in the air. And all of a sudden, it moves 2 feet to the right. How do they know to do that? Are they psychic? No. They're all moving left and right, up and down, you know, little quarter of an inch or whatever, little tiny motions constantly. And when 51% of them move in a particular direction, then the whole bunch goes whoop. Because they have very fast peripheral vision, and they're noticing what everybody's doing. They're voting, and they're measuring votes constantly. Nature is democratic. This study proved that Jefferson was right, that democracy is the essential and true nature of all of us. Thus, we can govern ourselves. Thus, no democratic nation has ever attacked another democratic nation in history. If we could just, and oddly enough, this is one of the things that the neocons are using as a justification to bomb Iraq into democracy. But nonetheless, that province ignored. Democracy is the natural state of things. And we don't need any institution, whether it be and I say this, you know, speaking as a Christian myself, we don't need churches and we don't need governments saying this is how it must be. The conservative worldview is that the purpose of government is to constrain people's natural evil impulses. The liberal worldview on which this country was founded, the worldview of the Enlightenment, is that the purpose of government is to allow people to express their greatest potential, to experience life, liberty, and to pursue happiness, rather than to be constrained. It's pretty straightforward stuff. 1-866-303-2270. I've covered a lot of territory here this morning. By the way, Alberto Gonzalez has just been subpoenaed. You will, sir, produce these documents. MSNBC is reporting that the House Judiciary Committee, this is from the Think Progress blog, has subpoenaed the Justice Department for a series of additional documents revealed last week by the American Spectator that have not been turned over to Congress. How much more is Alberto going to have to rehearse in the back room? Pete in San Francisco, California. Hey, Pete, what's on your mind today?
Pete? Hello, Pete. Hey, Tom?
You are live and on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate you very, very much. I love the conversation and where you're heading, and I want to kind of urge it to go in this direction when you talk about natural and religion. There's a couple of terms I want to introduce, and one of them that's important to me is that the Word of God is written in the fabric of nature. I mean, that's where it's written for anybody to read.
Well, that was Jefferson's idea. In fact, he took the first four Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament, the four Gospels, and took a razor blade to them, cut out all of the miracles, everything that was supernatural. And what's left, he said, is legitimate, and he published that as the Jefferson Bible, and it has been consistently in print from the time that, you know, from a few years before he died when it first went into print until today. It's still in print.
Right. Very much so. And another term that I think that when you talk about the deeper divisions and the deeper philosophical divisions between liberals and conservatives, one of the things that I think is the biggest important one, important to me, is that it's what I term the human supremacy movement. I've sort of made that terminology, which is basically the idea that humans are dominant in nature, which is stated on the first page of the Bible. If I look underneath, I think that is absolutely the greatest threat to our survival than anything else, and that is the fundamental division between, you know, the red and blue states, between the conservatives. Some people think that humans are dominant and see the world in sort of a pyramidal structure, and some people see that we're in a community of life where we have the same, you know, laws as all other species, and that is the crux of how you operate in the world, and it's like the fork in the road that makes huge differences in how, in policy and economics and everything else. And
I feel absolutely, like you know, yeah. Spot on. I absolutely agree with you, Pete, and well said. And that's one of the reasons why I'll say, you know, it's for us and for all life on Earth, because we are part of, I mean, we really very much are part of a larger organism called this planet. And when you're looking at the possibility of species extinction with the 30, 40, 50% of all species vanishing over the next 30 or 40 years, as Stuart Pym is suggesting may happen, E.O. Wilson, Harvard's biologist, writing about, you have to ask yourself, you know, okay, my body will function without one kidney. I can get around without one eye or one ear, relatively unimpaired. But if I were to lose half my organs or 30 or 40% of my organs, could I still function? I don't think so. So, Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Tom, I have some grave concerns. If we're going to have the Ten Commandments imposed upon us, which version are we going to use? Because I'm a staunch Lutheran, or I was, and by golly, I don't think those Presbyterians had the right set. And if we have to have the Presbyterian set of commandments, I'm just not going along with it.
Well, you know, there's not that much difference between the Lutheran and Presbyterian commandments, but there is a big difference between the Lutheran and the Catholic commandments and the Jewish commandments. I mean, there are three different versions, and you're absolutely right. There are different understandings and interpretations and literally versions of the Ten Commandments. So, yeah, good point. Rhetorical, but good point, Karen. Thank you. Jim in Portland. Hey, Jim.
Hi. Hey, I wanted to make a comment about education and religion. I'm all for it. But on an elective basis and basing that on my own experience, when I was going through high school in Arizona back in 76, there was no religious education. I was, you know, just at the point of being curious about it, you know, and wanting to actually read about it. You know, I was brought up a Catholic, and I went through all of that indoctrination, but I wanted to learn more.
Yeah, I think comparative religion should be taught in the United States, and we should and we should include within that under that umbrella not just all the religions of the world, the well-known, the big five, whatever it may be, or the three religions of the book, plus Buddhism and Hinduism and maybe Jainism and Sufi. Well, these they're variations of Buddhism and Islam, but also Wicca and also paganism and also animism and also frankly, I would say. Atheism as a religion, that is to say, as a belief system, as a coherent philosophy that is put forward as a belief system that has, frankly, no more or less support in human experience than any other, and let's just teach them comparatively without bias. I think that's a wise thing to do. But to say, oh, this is the one that we have to teach in our schools because this is what our nation was founded on. It's just factually wrong. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, MoveOn's executive director, MoveOn.org, Eli Pariser is moderating, and Air America has recorded questions from MoveOn members with answers from seven leading Democratic presidential candidates, Dodd, Kucinich, Richardson, Biden, Obama, Clinton, and Edwards, on the subject of Iraq. And both Air America and MoveOn are streaming it commercial-free on their sites tonight, Tuesday night, at 7 p.m., and then we'll rerun it on the network with commercials as two-hour specials three times, Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can get more information over at airamerica.com. And also, on April 15th at 4 p.m., I believe that's Sunday. Yeah, it is. It's the first anniversary party for 1480 KPHX in Phoenix, Arizona. And Mike Malloy, me, Stephanie Miller, Bill Press, Jeff Farias, and 1,500 of our closest friends will be celebrating the first year of that radio station's airing progressive talk radio. You can hang out with us and the staff and fellow liberals and progressives. And for more details and hotel accommodations and whatnot, go to 1480kphx.com. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Well, the president has invited Democrats to discuss the standoff over the war spending bill. So everyone's very excited about that. The only problem is that he's pretty much already said that he's not going to negotiate anything with them. He's said it's time for them to get the job done. And he said leaders in Congress can report on progress on getting an emergency spending bill to my desk. And he then basically goes on to say that nothing's changed.
I find this very bizarre, Victoria. The White House says, Bush's spokesmen say, or whatever, spokespeople, say he will not negotiate, he's not going to budge, he doesn't want to hear what Congress has to say, it's his way or the highway. And then he says, you guys want to come on over and talk?
That's right.
What am I missing?
Well, this is the president's version of being conciliatory and open to new ideas.
I see. People can come in and listen to what he has to say, and then they can leave.
That's right.
Do you think that, I mean, that one of two things is going on here. Either he's actually willing to negotiate, but he doesn't want to say it in public.
Which I don't think is the case.
Or he really and truly believes that Congress is going to show up and let him give a little speech and go, oh, okay, we get it. We see it your way, sir. Thank you very much. And go back home.
I don't know whether he believes that. So I think there may be a third way.
Which is
that he thinks that nothing's going to come of this, but he's going to do it anyway.
So it's political theater.
I think there may be that possibility, yes.
So what he's doing, it's CYA. What he's doing is he's doing the kabuki dance here so that he can say, well, at least I danced with you. He's saying, we tried.
I think that's a possibility. I think that's a possibility. Now, of course, in the meantime, the Democrats are coming back and saying, look, we're ready to sit down and talk with you, but Senator Reid saying today that Bush must agree to, quote, take a seat at the table of negotiation, of compromise, and of direction change. And, of course, that's about as likely to happen as what President Bush wants to happen is as likely to happen. So I don't think we're going to have a very happy meeting, if we even have a meeting at all.
Yeah, my hope on all this is that we end up with an impasse where Congress says, okay, you don't want to do it our way, we don't want to do it your way, so we're just going to go fix Social Security. And we'll talk to you later about Iraq. And which basically means that, George W. Bush has until August 1st to pull all of our troops out of Iraq.
Well, that would be fascinating.
It's the way that I think Congress should play it.
It's a very bold play, though, Tom, isn't it?
Yeah, and bold has not always been a word associated with Democrats.
No.
At least not in the last 40 years or so, but you never know.
You never know. I mean, and of course, they've got so many other things going on. You and I have talked many times about the number of hearings that are going on, and I said I didn't know the number, but one thing I have been able to find out, you may already know this, is that since the 30th of January, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, your friend Henry Waxman, has held 17 mm-hmm. hearings.
Yeah, and he's got his jaw clamped on Bush's pant leg here. Victoria, a couple of callers have questions that I think perhaps you have a better answer to than I. Bill in Madison, Wisconsin, you're live with Victoria Jones.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. My question for you is, what do you think about the subpoenas on Gonzalez? Where is this going to lead? What's the possible outcome of this as far as the president trying to keep things from coming out, or where do you see this going?
Could this be, Victoria, thank you, Bill, could this be Bush's Monica moment?
Yes, I think it possibly could. I think the subpoenas are where we start to see things go higher up and higher up and higher up. And this is where this ceases to become a game of chicken and becomes a game of a very, very big bird.
Yeah, interesting. Simon in Savannah, Georgia, you're live with Victoria Jones.
Hi, my question is, if Alberto Gonzalez was to resign on his own, will that stop the Senate investigations?
No, not at this point. It's become too big.
Okay, so they will still be able to subpoena him, regardless of his position in government, the same as Monica Goodling, they can still go after him.
I believe so, and I believe at this point that regardless of what he does, they feel that there's so much going on there that they want to find out. But he doesn't seem to have an ounce of either intelligence or integrity. I don't know which it is, or political instinct guiding him to do the resignation thing.
Yeah, well, I think he's always just been Mr. Bush's, fellow. He's, the guy who was there for George, and that's about the only role he's ever played. Michael in Seattle, we've got about 30 seconds, maybe 20 seconds. Quick question.
The thing that I'm bothered about is the Democratic Party in the House has gone ahead and passed the, has gone ahead and let Bush off the hook with saying that they have to go through the Congress to go to Iran, and the fact that the oil companies have split up all the oil for Iraq.
Yeah. So how are these things going to play out? Iran? My personal opinion is Bush has given up on Iran, but Cy Hirsch seems to think he's still got his eye on it.
I think he's still got his eye on Iran. I wish he'd just take his eye off on it and concentrate on something else.
Yeah, yeah. How about putting New Orleans back together?
Oh,
that would be a nice start. Indeed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks for being with us and thanks for taking the calls, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Peter Eisner up next on the Italian letter, how the administration used fake information to build a case for Iraq.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. How did the Bush administration build their phony case for a war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq? And then the eventual, now going on 4-year occupation of that country. Peter Eisner and Newt Royce lay out a rather startling agenda that we've talked about on this program, but they just do a brilliant job of documenting a new book called The Italian Letter. And Peter Eisner's on the line with us, Rodale.com, the website for the book. It, of course, is available in fine bookstores everywhere, online or in, you know, brick buildings and whatnot. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
So, The Italian Letter. How did this... This is the letter that came via Berlusconi to the Bush administration?
Yes, this is the letter, actually a little bit more difficult than directly from Berlusconi. It's a letter that was written supposedly by the president of the African country of Niger to Saddam Hussein, supposedly in 2000, saying that he confirmed that his country would sell 500 tons of uranium a year to Iraq. The Bush administration didn't see the letter right away, but the letter came to the CIA by way of Italian military services, the equivalent of the CIA, which started talking about this just a couple of days after 9/11.
And this was, my understanding is that there was some effort on the part of Mr. Berlusconi to ingratiate himself with Mr. Bush. What role did politics in Italy play in the production of this letter?
Well, the letter first surfaced in the form of word coming from the Italian intelligence service to the CIA station in Rome, saying that we have some information about Iraq and uranium. And the CIA station said, well, tell us more. And they gave them a first report, which was just in time to deliver to President Bush when Berlusconi made a trip to the United States with his intelligence chief on October 15th, 2001, just a month after 9/11. And this was the start of bringing material to Washington, claiming that Iraq, in fact, was trying to restart its nuclear program, which it wasn't.
Is there any evidence, Peter Eisner, that this is a closed loop, that the Bush administration said to Berlusconi directly or through back channels, we would really appreciate it if you'd help us out here, give us a justification to attack Iraq, and then Berlusconi's intelligence service says, oh, well, you know, we can, and they break into the ambassador's residence and steal the letterhead and create this letter?
We've heard a lot of speculation about that. We have not found that to be the case. The one thing that you can say is that the forgery of the letter and the accompanying dossier that lays out this supposed sale is so amateurish that you'd almost think it was hard to believe even for a bad intelligence service to put together such a rotten job. Dates are wrong. The names of people in some of the material are outdated.
Some of those people are dead.
Yeah, in some cases, yeah. You know, the wrong foreign minister. So if you're getting, you know, it doesn't seem to be a very decent job at going ahead if there were a more sophisticated operation going on. So we haven't figured out down to the bottom line, but we do think that there were rogue elements inside Italian intelligence that A, were trying to get money, and B, were trying to ingratiate themselves with the rest of the Italian government, whether or not higher ranking people in Italy might have known about it.
Now, when this information was first delivered to the Bush administration, when Berlusconi and his intelligence minister came over, the response of the U.S. intelligence services to it was?
They said that they had grave doubts right away, before they even saw the actual document. Their doubts were, first of all, that Italian intelligence services are not considered to be particularly reliable among Western agencies. Second of all, why would Saddam Hussein be trying to get uranium from Niger? Because Iraq already had uranium in its own stocks. And third of all, Niger was being very friendly with the United States, and it was risking a damaging relationship, and not to mention France controlled the mines in Niger, and France had already told the United States it was not likely.
So the Bush administration is given this information, they apparently George Bush as well, and the intelligence services of the United States say, not a chance, it's no good. And yet it shows up in the president's State of the Union address in the following spring. What's the series of events between the time that the Bush administration learns of the information and is told that it's no good and the time that they start peddling that information to promote the war?
Well, the problem is that they're never exactly told that it's no good. Intelligence services don't make blanket statements. They say things like highly unlikely, it's been reported, but we don't have full corroboration. You know, so they go into this bureaucratic mode, and it kind of provides loopholes. And meanwhile, many people inside the Bush administration on the political side, including Vice President Cheney and people in the Defense Intelligence Agency, kind of would prefer to look at the material in the worst possible light. So whoever in the CIA or at the State Department among intelligence analysts were trying to say, wait a minute, it's not corroborated, it doesn't make any sense, those people were being drowned out by the drumbeat saying, we got to find out more. Saddam Hussein is at work here. And it was really a sales job intended to promote the one thing that could really turn the public tide and the congressional tide, which is the threat of mushroom clouds on the horizon, which started to be the actual language that was being used.
So to what extent, when the Bush administration was peddling this information, did they realize that it was not credible? I mean, the bottom line here is, were we, based on your research, were we overtly lied to, or were we, I mean, were they saying, you know, this may or may not be right, let's run with it, or were they saying, you know, we're pretty sure this isn't right, but we're going to lie about it? I mean, there's a certain point where there's a threshold, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, Vice President Cheney was in a position to see all of the intelligence coming in. He was in a position to see the material that said, yes, we have this information, but there are caveats, that there are questions about why it would be so that Saddam Hussein was buying uranium, or why any of the other evidence might be corroborated. And the Vice President's office pushed the CIA repeatedly, did unprecedented things to pressure CIA analysts to make the worst case out of rotten intelligence, to say, yes, it's highly likely, yes, it's possible. It's very hard to use, you know, to say there's a they here. There are individuals operating in a bureaucracy. And clearly, there's enough information in the system to highly question this being drowned out by the drumbeat for war.
So, at what point did the Bush administration decide to move forward? And was this, first of all, was this the main device that they used to move forward into arguing in favor of the war, or was this peripheral?
In the summer of 2002, the Bush administration started an operation called the White House Iraq Group, and it was basically a PR operation to promote the war in Iraq. And it was decided that starting in September, as everybody came back from vacation, they would start talking more than anything about a nuclear program. And you started to hear on the first week in September a chorus on the Sunday talk shows, in the New York Times, other places, sources saying Iraq is restarting its nuclear program. So this body of evidence, the Italian letter and the surrounding dossier, were very important in selling the American people on the idea that this was the case. Now,
and thus the Bush administration's response when Joe Wilson blew it up, basically,
they blamed the messenger rather than the fact that they could have known all along that it wasn't true.
Peter Eisner and Newt Royce. Peter with us here, the author of The Italian Letter, How the Bush Administration Used a Fake Letter to Build a Case for War in Iraq. Peter, thanks for coming on the program and sharing this with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I sent a dream to you, baby, last night. I'm the end of the world.
Welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Senator John Kerry and former Speaker Newt Gingrich engaged in a head-to-head debate this morning on global warming. This is interesting. During the event, Kerry challenged Gingrich on his commitment to global warming science. This, by the way, from the Center for American Progress. Think Progress blog, asking him what his message would be to conservatives like James Inhofe who are resisting the science. Gingrich says, I think the evidence is sufficient. Interesting. See, what they're going to do. What the cons, this is just another opportunity for the cons to move us toward another centralized system. At the point where it becomes absolutely obvious that global warming is happening, that carbon is a problem in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide largely, specifically, although methane as well, but the carbon-based gases are a problem in the atmosphere, that global warming is real, at that point, they are going to have to move to something else that is highly centralized if they're going to go along with maintaining the idea that local communities should not have autonomy and power, that we should be in a driven from the top down economy essentially by large monopolies sanctioned by the power of the state, but run of by and for a small oligarchy of very wealthy and powerful interlocking organizations and families in the United States. Go to theyrule.net and just start looking at the interlocking boards. You can take, typically you can take any random, in my book, Unequal Protection, I did it with, I believe it was IBM and Marriott, but I'd have to go back and look. In any case, you can take just a couple of random corporations and just start looking at who's on the board of company A, and that will lead you to somebody who's on the board of company B, who will lead you to somebody who shares a board member with company C, who shares a board member with company D, and you can go through, 40, 50 companies and come all the way back to company A. There is this relatively small network in the United States of people on the boards of these very large and very powerful corporations, and they are not going to let go of the hold that they have around your neck and mine in terms of providing electricity to us. At the same time that all across Germany, and frankly in many other countries in the world, I remember 20 years ago, first time I went to Israel, one of the things that I noticed was how on virtually every roof there was a solar water heater. People were getting all their hot water from sunlight. And all over the world, power is being decentralized. Well, not in every place, but every place where the people have some say in things, power is being decentralized. Local communities are taking it over. Individual homes are. The program in Germany where they said you can, the banks are forced to give you a 10-year mortgage on a major solar installation covering, most of the south-facing surface of your roof. And the utilities must buy back that electricity during those 10 years of that mortgage from you at 7 times the going rate, because that's what it's going to cost to build a nuclear power plant. And instead, we want to build the same amount of infrastructure, only have it be distributed over millions of homes on their roofs. And there won't be losses on the long lines, the long power lines, and the power will be available at a local level. At the end of 10 years, the power companies don't have to pay a premium anymore. They just pay what the going rate is. At the end of 10 years, you've paid off the mortgage on it. And these are solar installations and solar systems that typically have a lifespan of 50 years. So what the cons are going to do is that at the point at which they begin to acknowledge the reality of the problems of global warming, that's the point at which they're going to begin to promote another centralized solution, specifically nuclear power. That's the road they're traveling down. Or maybe we can come up with super scrubbers for coal-fired power plants or whatever. But it's going to be all about let's maintain the stranglehold of big power Enron getting so powerful that they the guys could make jokes about, you know, Aunt Millie. And how and you know, let's cut the power off to Grandma. Arnold Schwarzenegger meeting with Ken Lay secretly before they began the campaign to take down Gray Davis, before they began the campaign of rolling blackouts across California, if the press reports are to be believed. And I would love to see an investigation of that one, right, in California. Not going to happen, but at least as long as Schwarzenegger's governor. But the power, just the raw power of Enron to bring down the governor of a state that represents the sixth largest economy in the world, that represents, you know, a very substantial portion of the population of the United States and the economy of the United States, the power of these energy companies, they are not going to let go of this power easily. And so people think, oh, it's a big victory. Gingrich says that Inhofe is nuts. Well, he didn't quite say that, but Gingrich disavows Inhofe. Isn't that marvelous? The conservatives are going our way. Well, of course, at a certain point, you can't deny any longer that the Earth is round. At a certain point, you can't deny any longer that the atmosphere needs to be cleaned up. And so then the question becomes, how? Well, let's do it in a way that continues to maintain centralized power and control over economies as well as energy. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number.
The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. I might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, I'll go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I drank a little beer that evening, sang a little bit of these working man blues.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. And let's see here, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey,
did
Gary.
Did you hear that giant sucking sound every morning?
So the giant sucking sound?
On hogs at the trough.
Oh, yeah, they certainly are.
Continues to be the politics of, I have a comment if I may. It continues to be the politics of greed, the continued attack to the wonderful middle class of our country.
Uh-huh.
And if we finally, if we don't elect a president once and for all who appeals to our best instincts and brings out the best in us, then there won't be much of a country left.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, Gary. Well said. Lewis in Manhattan. Hey, Lewis, welcome to the program. Oh, Lewis just vanished, and I think we have the magic problem with the phone software here, where when I put somebody on the air, somebody else and Lauren answers it grabs it. Bruce in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Bruce.
Hi. Nice to talk to you, Tom. I'm actually in the coastal range over in Lee's Camp, and nobody's ever heard of that. I'm from New England, and I grew up in Massachusetts, and I had an opportunity when I was a kid in the early 70s to work waitering and busboy up in Kennebunkport. And
mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because I've been living out here for quite a while, and the people out here don't seem to even have a grasp of that there is, in fact, a ruling class. That there's you kind of see it on the East Coast. You can't avoid it, really. But out
yeah.
here, and a lot of my research has been into learning more about that. And I had a question for you.
Yeah.
I've read about. I have books like Further Up the Organization by Robert Townsend. He wrote it in 70, I believe. And
what's the question, Bruce?
It's who's doing this research now? William Domhoff's books are out of date. Who's writing about who are the upper crust families? Who are the who make up? Domhoff?
I think there's a variety of good folks out there who are writing on it. William Grider is probably one of the very best. You know, there's no shortage of it. Frankly, if you want to, if you really want to see, you know, pull back the curtain and see what's going on, subscribe to The Nation. The Nation magazine is a great source of this kind of information. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yes, thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, we already know that Bush lied us into this morally indefensible war and occupation in Iraq. And so for me, the bigger issue right now is what Congress is going to do with respect to Iraq and the U.S. troops there. For instance, will Congress eventually cave in and in the end give Bush all the war money he wants without any legally binding troop withdrawal deadline attached to the money? And that for me is really the bigger issue. And I think we all really need to call our congresspeople and email them and our senators as well, and let them know that, remind them that one of the main reasons that they want any kind of majority in Congress at all, even though it's slim in the Senate, but the main reason they want any kind of majority is because of widespread opposition to the war in Iraq by nearly a two-thirds majority of the American public, and because most of us Americans want to see the war, we want to see the troops withdrawn from Iraq as soon as possible, which means like starting in 6 months, not
starting right now. I mean, if Congress were to say to Bush, okay, thank you very much, you vetoed our legislation, we offered you the money you wanted, we gave you a timetable that stretches out a year and a half, which is way beyond what the vast majority of Americans want, and way beyond, incidentally, what the troops want, if you look at the surveys of the troops, and beyond what the Iraqis want. The only guy who wants our troops to still be over there is Bush. And if the Congress were to say, okay, fine, you know, we gave you what you wanted, or actually probably more than you should have, you know, we gave you a bill that actually would have been a huge gift. It would have allowed the Republicans to claim victory before the elections of 2008. In fact, that was my concern about this piece of legislation, is that if Bush was forced by virtue of this law to end the war in the spring or summer of 2008, then the Republicans would be all over it in the fall of 2008 saying, we won the, we're successful. Look at that. They would declare victory and come home and everybody would go, whoa, that's great. But now Bush has said, no, I'm going to veto it. And when he vetoes it, I think that they should say, okay, cool, you vetoed it. We're out of here. Lewis in Manhattan. Hey, Lewis, what's up?
Yeah, I was trying to tell you, I got disconnected, but the military-industrial complex is part of the problem. It's the military-religious complex. All the money being channeled, non-taxpaying money, they're accumulating great, great wealth by not paying taxes, channeling it through big corporations, and that's where the centralization and the consolidation is coming from.
No, well, the centralization and consolidation is coming from, you know, wealth wanting to hang on to wealth and exercising power. But you're absolutely right, Lewis, that there is something I think to be very, very concerned about. And we had the fellow on the other day who wrote the book about the Air Force Academy, Mikey Weinstein, as I recall his name is, and, you know, who's suing them about the rampant evangelism throughout our military, there's a group that is actually very effectively turning our military into a religious institution, and that's not good for the United States, frankly. Louie in Granite Falls, Washington. Hey, Louie.
Hi, this is Louie in Granite Falls. Glad to hear you, Tom, a long-time listener.
Thank you.
I got a couple of things. One is there's a statement, there's been never been a government that's been designed by man that someone hasn't tried to turn around and hotwire about 5 minutes after the ink was dry on it. And the second one is...
I'd say the same is true of religions, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I'm off the grid with solar panels myself, and whether or not they do some sort of thing where the power companies pay a premium for power that's generated locally, it's still a good place to put your money, because for those of you that use the stuff out on the street, or at least Federal Reserve notes, it's sinking rapidly, and panel prices,
Louis,
and silicon is tough to get.
Yeah, Louis, is Granite Falls on the western end or the eastern end of Washington? Or I mean, where are you relative to where the rain is almost always falling?
I'm in western Washington where there's heaps of rain, and Granite Falls is in a convergence zone, and it rains like a big dog. Last summer, however, I had to start the generator for about an hour and a half a week to pump up my well, and that was it. I've got four panels, 480 watts installed, and
sure, you're getting plenty of power through the cloud layer.
No, the cloud layer definitely does cut down on it. The silicon solar panels, they operate mostly in a higher spectrum than UV. UV will get through clouds, but the higher spectrums generally don't.
Interesting. So you just have to have a whole lot more of it to deal with the attenuation from the clouds?
Exactly. The outfit I deal with, their catalog includes a map of the United States, and 100%, we're in an area where 100% of the recommended amount would need to be put up in the way of panels, and you've got less in the Southwest and various other places because they have more sun and
That's
less
great.
Clouds.
That's great. Well, Louis, I salute you. Good on you for going off the grid and for declaring your independence here in the United States. Stuart in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just want to ask you, I mean, with this whole debate about the, you know, extra spending bill, mm-hmm. one of the benchmarks in it is the oil sharing agreement, that they have to sign the oil sharing agreement before we get out of there. I mean,
right.
isn't that what the Bushies are all after, is the oil?
Yep. Yeah, and Congress walked right into that. I mean, they even built it into their legislation. But again, this is, you know, it gets back to there is an old boy network, and it has its tentacles in both parties. And the oil industry is not a Republican industry. It is a, you know, a power and money industry. It is an energy industry. And it's one of the reasons why we, the people, have to be the ultimate watchdogs in this stuff. We have to be the ones pointing it out. And as I think it was Jerry called earlier and said, we need to be calling Congress. We do. And here's a toll-free number that you can use to call your member of Congress, your member of the House of Representatives or the Senate, 866-220-0044. Toll-free, 866-220-0044. Or just call their direct line. You know, if you have free long distance, or even if you're willing to pick up the call. I mean, it's a small cost for democracy, right? Area code 202. This gets you the switchboard on Capitol Hill. 202-225-3121. Dave in Hollywood, California. Hey, Dave, we've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Good, Tom. 3 months before Gray Davis became governor, the first time I saw him having dinner with Charles Keating at the Four Seasons Hotel in Los Angeles. It's another piece of the puzzle with Arnold and Ken Leahy meeting. And if we put Neil Bush in there, I think we got a big piece of the puzzle. It all goes
So wait a minute. You saw Gray Davis having dinner with
Charles Keating?
Or
Keating. 3 months before Gray Davis became governor the first time, they walked in the restaurant with Keating's bodyguard, and Gray Davis seemed like he was going to do anything Charles said.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's like, you know, suck up to power, suck up to money, and next thing you know, you're the governor? Is that
yeah,
the,
and then
the,
you get booed. He was used like a pawn, Gray Davis. He's a total idiot, and he was just used like a pawn by the SNL boys and Ken Leahy.
Yeah, it's tragic to hear, Dave. Thanks for thanks for the tip. Mr. Bush's brother certainly came out of the savings and loan scandal well, and the whole Silverado thing and Neil Bush. Oh, man. 45 minutes past the hour. Back to your calls in just a minute, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Stick around.
Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270. Intelligent. Compelling. Confrontational. Air America's Randy Rhodes.
People understand chemical addictions. Booze. Cocaine. But once an addict puts down the bottle and the spoon, something else has to fill the hole. There's an addiction to power playing out right before our eyes, and the bodies just keep piling up. Join me for the next Randy Rhodes Show.
The Randy Rhodes Show on Air America. Radio only smarter.
Stay tuned for the Randy Rhodes Show, coming up next on Air America Radio. Well, if you look at the Bush administration, somehow I think not. Welcome back. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's Air America Radio. Tom Hartman with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. And John in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Love the show and love the depth and the breadth. But the question is, you talked earlier in the week about, last week about Thomas Hobbes and Leviathan. And
right.
I didn't, when I read it, I had to read the front page that was a condensation because I couldn't really understand his diction. But what I took from that was that greedy people can't be satisfied, and that's why we have to keep them out of the heads of government. But my real question is whether they're how big a danger it is. If you look at from the 80s on, the top CEOs and top 1% began paying them their compensation at geometrically increasing rates, it seems like.
Yeah, it has been. The situation, I mean, starting in 1980 with Reagan coming along and saying that the only reason that anybody does anything, and this is, you know, part of the conservative mantra, the only reason that anybody does anything is for enlightened self-interest. This is, you know, you'll find this at the core of libertarian thought and of much conservative thought. And therefore, you want to try and channel greed. That altruism, that egalitarianism, that the idea of community, that the idea that we're all in this together is something that just, you know, isn't part of the American or the human experience in their minds. And so Hobbes, on the one hand, was saying, yes, people are evil and government needs to be a constraining force on them in all regards. And the purpose of it is to constrain. And at the same time, when you've got, you know, Reagan coming into office with the same philosophy, essentially this Hobbesian philosophy, they don't believe in government and therefore they can't govern. They don't believe that government is there to help people achieve their greatest goals or to achieve their highest ideals. Instead, they believe that the only purpose of government is to restrain people. So the only thing the government should have or be is police or armies. I mean, that's it. That's in their mind. And whereas the founders of this republic thought that the purpose of government goes way beyond restraining people. In fact, that's not even the primary purpose. You won't even find that in the preamble to the Constitution. That the purpose of government is to help people achieve their greatest potential. And that was beyond Hobbes's grasp. It took another 50 years for John Locke to come along and articulate that. And then another 100 years after that, that Thomas Jefferson came along and took Locke's life, liberty, and private property, or life, liberty, and estate was how Locke said it, and change it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So it's an interesting point, John, and I appreciate the call and a topic I love talking about, but back to the real world here. Thanks for the call. Steve in Albany, New York. Hey, Steve.
Hello, Tom. This is Steve in Albany, and thanks for taking my call. I'm just beside myself today because you talk a lot about, you know, single-payer health care on the show, and my wife got to work this morning and discovered that one of her coworkers was arrested over the weekend because he robbed a liquor store, presumably to help pay his medical bills. He has a young daughter who's like 6 years old who's had, you know, a birth defect and just multiple surgeries to just keep her alive. She had her biggest surgery last fall. And I am just so upset today. I haven't had any idea what to do. I work from home, so I don't have anybody to talk to.
You just let it out. I mean, this is, I remember noticing maybe 15 years ago the appearance of these cans in, you know, you'd walk into a convenience store and there's a can with somebody's picture on it and say, you know, Susie needs a liver transplant or something like that. And it was somebody in the neighborhood. I mean, this wasn't, you know, walking into the store in Michigan and seeing Susie in California needs a liver transplant. It was a Susie who lives three blocks down the street needs a liver transplant. And I think that there's a growing realization on the part of Americans that this is wrong, that this is tragic, that this is a disaster, our health care system in this country. And that's why the vast majority of Americans are in favor of a national health care program, a single-payer health care program. And that's why the great tragedy frankly, the Democrats not standing up and saying, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. 36 of the other 37 industrialized countries in the world have figured out ways to do it. We can do it without bringing, you know, without having William McGuire of, I think it's United Healthcare, make another $1.78 billion paycheck. Thank you very much. So good point, Steve, and thanks for calling and letting loose on it. I'm really sorry to hear about your friend and It's a good lesson for all of us. You did good. Ron in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Dan. Hey, Ron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm a disgruntled, old-style Republican, and I'm a little more than disgruntled. I'm angry at what's going on in my party because it's not the party I joined.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to give a suggestion to the left. I've been trying to spur a movement on that the left should be buying shares of Halliburton
and Bechtel and some of these other no-bid corporations and voting out.
Yeah, there's not enough of us. And did you see where Halliburton just spun off KBR? KBR is going to be what gets investigated. KBR now is a Cayman Islands company, as I recall. Halliburton is in the process of moving to Dubai. It's just, you know, there's the governance. See, the problem, the fundamental fallacy, Ron, and you know, it's a good try, and I appreciate it. I appreciate you thinking about this. But the fundamental fallacy is that somehow the way to solve these problems is to take control of the corporations by ourselves, you know, to buy into the system, to participate in the system. In other words, to vote with our dollars. And when you vote with your dollars, you don't have democracy. Democracy is you vote with your vote. If you vote with your dollars, then the people with the most dollars have the most vote. That's not democracy. And it's not about, you know, Halliburton being good or evil. It's about whether we have laws that prevent Halliburton from being good or evil. Now, in that regard, when it comes to corporations, I'm a Hobbesian. Corporations are designed to do things that may be destructive to society, and therefore they should be constrained by the force of government, frankly. Coming up tomorrow on the Next Tom Hartman program, I'll be shaking it up with Colonel David Hunt on his new book on The Hunt, How to Win the War on Terror, Support Our Troops, and Protect Our Liberty at Home. Good conservative. In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, John Henry Clippinger is here on A Crowd of One, The Future of Individual Identity. That and the rest of the news, the best of the rest of the news, and your calls. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.